In the account of a long, varied and difficult life given by the formerly enslaved abolitionist activist Alauda Equiano, he told of his first encounters with the written word. I'd often seen my master and Dick employed in reading, and I had a great curiosity to talk to the books, as I thought they did, and so to learn how all things had a beginning. For that purpose, I've often taken up a book and have talked to it, and then put my ears to it, when alone, in hopes it would answer me. And I've been very much concerned when I found it remained silent. As with many other Black Atlantic writers of the 18th century, Equiano dramatised the encounters of the early modern world as encounters between the oral and the literate. The idea of the talking book signals the misrecognition of the written word and the gulf between orality and literacy. This is even clearer in a story that Equiano's fellow campaigner against slavery, Quobnar Otobar Quaguano, borrowed from William Robertson's History of America. As he tells it, on being presented with a Christian breviary, the Inca opened it eagerly, and then turning over the leaves, lifted it to his ear. "This," says he, "is silent. It tells me nothing." And he threw it with disdain to the ground. The Inca, Quaguano reported, was then murderously attacked by the Spanish for this desecration of a sacred book. Such ideas of the power of the written or printed word and their transformations of the oral cultures of indigenous and transplanted peoples within Africa, Asia and the Americas as part of the making of empires are well established within historical and geographical work on the early modern world. There are certainly accounts that insist upon the imperializing power of such marks on paper. These are countered, of course, by those who rightly emphasize the continuing power of oral and performative practices under the most difficult of circumstances, including slavery in the Americas. In between these positions, there are attempts to reveal the interdependencies between indigenous forms of communication, both oral and inscribed or materialized in various ways, and the European world of script and print. On the one hand, it's clear that Equiano and Quaguano were demonstrating that they had bridged the gulf, learned to read, learned to write, and turned that power to their own ends against the claims of those who would have enslaved them and those like them. On the other hand, Susan Scott Parish has argued in her account of the making of natural historical knowledge in the colonial British Atlantic world as an interaction between indigenous people, enslaved Africans and Europeans that, to quote her, it was the talking woods more than the talking book that was the trope of the Anglo-African experience. It was the oral transmission of knowledge of flora and fauna that offered some measure of efficacy and continuity in the formation of African identity. What all of these accounts underplay, however, and what I want to stress, is the extent to which the European culture of empire was itself an oral culture too. This is evident in speeches, proclamations, sermons, debates, and all sorts of declarations and conversations. Understanding questions of communication, information, and the making of knowledge as part of the historical geography of empire building and colonization requires us to understand the power of speech. This, I want to argue, is both something that's difficult to do and an opportunity to be grasped. Now, there's an impossibility at the heart of undertaking an historical geography of the spoken word. Back beyond the reach of oral history, the only access that there is to speech is through the texts and images that record it in some way or give access to how talk was organised. However, if the focus is not on precisely what was said, or even on sociolinguistic questions about how it was said, but on the conditions of speaking itself in particular contexts, then the question of what the sources can tell us becomes less of a problem. Firstly, the concern then becomes one of reconstructing the rules governing forms of speech, debates, sermons, proclamations, polite conversations, and so on, rather than particular instances of speaking, and those rules were certainly outlined and debated in writing. Secondly, those forms of speech were ones that were increasingly, and for more and more people, combined in a variety of ways with forms of script and print, particularly through the processes of imperialism and colonisation. Therefore, it's not the particular claims of orality that are of interest, but understanding the relationships between speech, script, and print, or between the practices of speaking, writing, and printing. This attention to practice and to the practicalities of forms of speech and their relationships to ways of producing, reproducing, and using texts means that it's necessary to consider the specific historical geographies of the spoken word. The same sort of work as has been done on script and print can be undertaken on the spoken word, understanding it as a set of historically and geographically differentiated embodied practices to which different people had unequal access, and which were both shaped by and shaped the spaces in which they took place. Considering the spoken word in terms of particular localized and historicized practices points towards arenas within which are built relatively formal conventions for speech that might be adopted, ignored, refused, or contested. Both the establishing of conventions and the process of challenging them produces the sources that can be interpreted. In what follows, I want to consider the forms of talk that were at work within the law in the British Atlantic world, particularly the taking of oaths and the giving of evidence, and to examine the ways in which they were instantiated and contested within Britain's colonies in the Caribbean. This means considering the power of speech as its historically and geographically specific forms work to simultaneously make up and unmake the radically unequal social relations of slavery in the plantation societies of Barbados and Jamaica. So first, a short section on the geography of the law in the Atlantic. Now, the law is a domain within which the spoken word, voiced in particular ways by specific people in defined spaces, is of fundamental importance as a guarantee of truth. It works through a very localized historical geography of speech. Yet the law is also an arena of practice that was crucial in structuring the social and political relationships of the British Atlantic world at a transoceanic scale. In interpreting the latter, Atlantic historians have taken up a terminology of legal geographies and legal spaces in order to delineate the geographical patterning of legal jurisdictions under which Britain's Atlantic Empire was governed. For example, Elijah Gould argues that while the conventions of the European Law of Nations governing questions of war and peace, and the more specific provisions of the English Common Law governing colonial societies, were understood as overarching frameworks for Atlantic governance, this was accompanied by the recognition of significant differences between zones of law in Europe and the settler colonies, and zones of violence in the terrestrial and oceanic imperial peripheries. This made possible significant legal differences between places, the continuation of warfare in the Caribbean among nations which had made peace in Europe, or vice versa, the legal foundation of chattel slavery in American plantation societies, but not in Britain, and the coexistence of multiple legal jurisdictions, including those of African polities and American maroon communities of former slaves, which were accepted by English traders, settlers, and imperial administrators. Establishing rules, rights, powers, and obligations within this complex and differentiated legal geography mattered to those on both sides of the Atlantic who took up the task of colonial governance. There was, therefore, a transatlantic debate over legal geography that meant that the law needs to be understood at very different, albeit connected, scales, from testimony given in the witness box to the Atlantic geography of differentiated legal zones. Moreover, the significance of law to the governance of colonies and the identity of colonists meant that legal practice was a contested field both locally and across the Atlantic. In this paper, I want to demonstrate the processes whereby a differentiated set of legal subjects were made within this legal geography through the spoken word, examining the ways in which oath-taking and evidence-giving were an important ground in the formation of those who were to be subject to the law in different and very unequal ways. What becomes apparent in it is that in this process of the constant and ongoing production and reproduction of these legal subjectivities through speech, gaps and contradictions were also opened up. The claims of race, nation, liberty, religion, gender and property intersected in ways that certainly drew strong distinctions between different sorts of legal subjects. However, when questions about the law were part of a transatlantic discussion over colonial rule, these multiple axes also complicated the ways in which the distinctions between people could be drawn and even undermined them. So I want to show how speech, first of all, constitutes these legal subjectivities, and then how discussions and debates over those forms of speech also serve to undermine them. So first of all, then, to think about oaths and taking oaths. The practices of government and law in 17th and 18th century Barbados and Jamaica were produced through and reproduced the social relations of race, gender, property and liberty. This was enacted through the spoken word, but it was also dependent upon it as more than just words. For example, members of the island's assemblies were white, Protestant, male, free and property. But while these were necessary qualifications, they weren't sufficient ones. Assemblymen needed to swear a series of oaths before they could take office. After the restoration of Charles II, they had to swear the oaths of allegiance and supremacy required of every office holder in England and the colonies, affirming their belief that the monarch was the head of both church and state. These oaths meant giving their solemn word to reject any claims that other monarchs and other churches might have. The Barbadian legislation prescribed that this was to take place in person, in public and open court, and that those taking the oath must declare that there is not any transubstantiation in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper or in the elements of bread and wine. These oaths also had to be sworn by any stranger applying for a patent for naturalisation in Jamaica, whereby they might enjoy the immunities and privileges of this island in as ample manner as any natural-born subject. In addition, Jamaican assemblymen had to swear an oath that they had sufficient property to qualify for office, and the governor and council of Barbados had to swear one before they could judge property cases in the courts of error and equity. On the basis of contemporary ideas about who could effectively give their word, free white gentlemen, such oaths bound together the social relations of a slave society and the public roles within its state apparatus to create a set of legal subjectivities which were at once materially embodied and linguistically constructed. These oaths were of such significance that one had to be instituted in 1692 to quell the doubts and scruples touching the authority of the Jamaican Council to sit and judge in matters of equity, and the oath guaranteeing the island's assemblymen had sufficient property needed to be rewritten in 1760 to address the many doubts that had arisen about its wording. These oaths were, therefore, part of the considerable armoury of oath-taking that underpinned government and law in the Caribbean, and along with colonial legislation, constituted different sorts of legal subjects on the island. This provided a continuity of practice with the English legal and governmental apparatus, from which the Caribbean versions derived some of their legitimacy and some guarantees against corruption and mismanagement, or at least a sense of accountability. Oaths were of undoubted importance. On the occasion of the arrival of a new governor to the island in 1732, a contributor to the Barbados Gazette pointedly argued that oaths were used in all civilized countries and nations in order to more firmly bind the takers to declare the truth or to perform the thing thereby promised to be done for the fear of offending invisible powers or the dread of subjecting themselves to the penalty which the laws of the society annex to the crime of swearing falsely. He used his reading of Coke, Pufendorf, Cicero, Machiavelli and others to remind his fellow islanders and those who governed them of the binding nature of an oath. A subsequent contributor to the same newspaper reinforced the point by informing readers that the British King's coronation oath obliged him to provide officers for the execution of justice, who then spoke in the King's name the words the author claimed were at the head of the Magna Carta: "We will not sell justice, we will not deny justice, we will not delay justice to anyone." He hoped that such oaths sworn by magistrates, along with the oaths of supremacy and allegiance, might be set up in capital letters in all courtrooms, keeping to their duty judges in a distant colony who cannot be expected to have the same great talents and endowments which are generally seen in those of our mother country. Oath-taking was also fundamental to the jury trial, he said, a very ancient institution which has been continued down through a succession of ages as one of the greatest privileges of Englishmen. Both judges and jurymen had to have their oaths administered by the correct authorities in the proper wording in open court. Witnesses were also to give their evidence on oath. Such oaths were to be sworn on the Christian Bible to bring internal moral force as well as external legal pressure to bear. The author quoted Archbishop Tillotson that perjury is treason against human society, subverting at once the foundations of public peace and justice and the private security of every man's life and fortune. Oaths and associated forms of giving one's word were also central to the legal and governmental regulations that underpin the doing of business on and with the island. These then were the words that the white, property-free and predominantly male members of this slave society said in public amongst themselves. Some people found a partial inclusion. Quakers, for example, were able to swear a different oath to allow them to secure their property, but this did not qualify them to give evidence in criminal trials, serve on juries, hold public office or open schools. Others were categorically excluded. Women could own property, but they could not hold public office. In 1708, the Jamaican Assembly passed a motion that no Jew, mulatto, Negro, or Indian shall have any vote at any election of members to serve in any assembly of this island. A 1711 law also excluded them from being capable to officiate or be employed to write in or for any of the offices of government in the island. This was part of a differentiation of legal and political subjectivities on the basis of race, gender, liberty, religion, and property. Similarly, the Barbadian Assembly ruled in 1709 and 1720 that no person whatsoever shall be admitted as a freeholder and therefore able to vote for or sit in the Assembly, or an evidence in any case whatsoever whose original extraction shall be proved to have been from a Negro, except only on the trial of Negroes and other slaves. This clause was to be read out twice a year in all the island's parish churches. Oaths, I'm arguing, were the embodied, localised and particularised performance of specific speech acts which enacted certain power-laden identities and social relations. They could only be spoken by certain sorts of people, predominantly free, white, Anglican, propertied men, in order to enable those people to, for example, hold office, guarantee statements or transfer property. Yet they were necessary in that they had to be spoken for the social attributes of freedom, masculinity, whiteness, and property holding to be turned into active social relations. Those axes of social difference were not enough on their own. Without swearing the right oath in the right place at the right time, the processes of institutionalisation, which were both intensely local and broadly transatlantic, would not take place. This was certainly a process by which privilege was consolidated and legitimated, even if only to the privileged themselves. However, it was never a completely clear-cut set of exclusions based on simple and essentialized categories and identities. As the next part of this paper argues, a crucial form of such talk, the right to give evidence in court, was both structured to institutionalize radically unequal social relations and was the subject of ongoing contention and transformation as the cross-cutting social relations of plantation society were debated across the Atlantic. So I want to turn now to questions of evidence. Law and governance on Britain's Caribbean islands depended upon both the Atlantic differentiation of zones of law and zones of violence that I've outlined, and an internal differentiation of legal subjectivities based primarily on the categories of race, freedom, and religion. Within this, the enslaved have been presented in contrasting ways, as either existing in a situation of bare life, entirely beyond the law, or quite to the contrary, as interested and active participants in the island's legal processes. They're perhaps best understood as having very heavily circumscribed and highly contingent legal subjectivities. On the one hand, the island's judicial systems, including separate courts for the free and the unfree, acted to reinforce planter power and to terrorise the enslaved, rather than to knit them into a unitary society. On the other hand, the enslaved were part of the public realm of law, rather than just the private realm of personal property. For example, one 18th century historian of Jamaica repeated the planter's self-serving claim that the enslaved were better off in the Caribbean than in Africa, since they were provided with food, clothing and shelter, but also with legal rights, since their liberty in their own country was not any more than nominal or imaginary. As he put it, for as many of them were subject to the arbitrary will and pleasure of their kings or chief men who disposed of them as they thought proper and had an absolute power of life and death, they may justly be said to be less slaves in our plantations than they were in their own country, because in our plantations, their masters are allowed no power of life and death over their slaves, and are even restrained from maiming or dismembering them upon any pretense whatsoever without a legal trial. While there was a disjuncture between what was in the statute books and the actual practice of violence and prosecution on the plantations and in the courts, The situation of the enslaved does not simply accord with the pure absolutism of Giorgio Agamben's Homo Sacer, a figure who can be killed without it being sacrilege, execution, or murder. Instead, by law in Jamaica, killing one of the enslaved was not murder, but killing two was. Such forms of very severely circumscribed legal personality were also evident elsewhere in the legal system. British colonial slave laws, in order to punish slaves for their crimes, were based on the notion that the enslaved were endowed with will, but this raised questions about their evidence and when it could be given and against whom. In Jamaican courts trying slaves, it was ordered that the evidence of one slave against another shall be deemed good and sufficient proof, and the enslaved were to be punished, albeit more harshly than others, for perjury. Indeed, for some crimes, particularly those relating to resistance against the plantation system, slave evidence was crucial to prosecutions. So therefore, slave evidence was necessary, denied in some cases, but necessary in others. It has this contradictory nature. In Barbados, there was a conflation of categories, whereby it was enacted in 1688 that any Negro slave or slaves would be tried by two justices of the peace and three freeholders, considering the evidence, proofs and testimonies or violent circumstances for and against them. Race and unfreedom were fettered together via the assumed brutishness of Africans. This combination of racist assumptions and an acknowledgement of the conditions under which the unfree gave their testimony also provoked suspicion about the use of slave or Negro evidence. Richard Hall, a lawyer and member of the Barbadian Assembly, glossing the 1688 Act in 1764 and highlighting its inclusion of this idea of violent circumstances, revealed these anxieties in his hope that other evidence would be found. He wouldn't have to rely upon slave testimony or slave evidence. As he said, a violent presumption amounts in law to full proof, that is, where circumstances speak so strongly that to suppose the contrary would be absurd, and where that presumption necessarily arises from such circumstances. They are more convincing and satisfactory than any other kind of evidence, because facts cannot lie. But the spoken testimony of Negroes and slaves could not be avoided, neither could the differences between those two categories of Negroes and slaves. In 1739, concerned about the inconveniences presented by free Negroes, Indians, or mulattoes, the Barbados Assembly enacted that the evidence of slaves, quote, where the same is supported with very good and sufficient corroborating circumstances, presented against any free Negro, Indian or mulatto, whether baptized or not, was to be deemed as good, valid and effectual in law as if the slave giving evidence or testimony was free, baptized and not under servitude or bondage to any person whatsoever. So they're willfully and imaginatively shifted into a different category. Hall was quick to spot the contradiction. Since the Barbados Assembly had ruled out evidence from anyone whose original extraction shall be proved to have been from a Negro, except only on the trial of Negroes and other slaves, then it was unclear whether their evidence was in fact valid against free people of colour or not. In part, this situation arose out of the contradictions of a plantation system that depended upon the human capacities, agency, and supernatural beliefs of the enslaved, while simultaneously denying all three. Certainly, enslaved Africans were precluded from taking oaths in court, but were cruelly punished for swearing them between themselves as part of a conspiracy or rebellion. Slave owners and overseers might even use the otherwise vilified oath-taking practices of the enslaved, including rituals involving the consumption of grave dirt and the invoking of spirit worlds, in theft investigation rites, a sort of informal court, informal justice, on the plantations. Such contradictions were heightened by the transatlantic disjunctures and conflicts that defined the age of abolition, when the institution of slavery came under attack on the basis of notions of right, justice, and morality. In Barbados in the 1780s, the reforming plantation owner Joshua Steele put the question of evidence giving right at the heart of his critique of plantation slavery. Indeed, he organised his attack on the system of slavery around the problems that precluding Negro evidence against all but enslaved Africans created for slave societies. In his published writings, Steele imagined a series of conversations between a clergyman and his planter acquaintances over cards, food and drink at their homes and at Mr. T's store. Their debates over Negro evidence played upon the question of Atlantic legal geography, contrasting the situation in Barbados to that in England, where all ranks of men, slaves, bondmen and apprentices are admitted as legal evidences. Steele also had an imaginary newcomer to the island find himself surprised to find among English people a mode of thinking and a system of laws so new to me. Barbadian planters faced, Steele argued, a series of evils principally derived from some impolitic system woven into the web of your motley laws. Since 60 years before, in 1720, in the frenzy of a contested election, a law, to quote Steele, a law disgraceful to humanity was passed in the colony, that no descendant of Negroes shall give evidence in any case except the trial of slaves. Significantly, picking away at the question of evidence giving meant unravelling whole swathes of the system of racial slavery and calling fundamental powers and beliefs into question. Steele's clergymen questioned the legal basis on which the island's legislature claimed the authority, quote, to disqualify generally any class of subjects of whatever complexion born within the British dominions and under the allegiance of the Crown. He suggested that these laws were repugnant to the laws of England, and that's what the debate over colonial legislation is always about, the repugnancy of laws. So Steele is trying to exploit the gap between legislation in Britain and legislation in the colonies. And it's part of a very long-running series of debates, so it fits right into that. So he suggested these laws were repugnant to the laws of England and asked whether they shouldn't then be repealed. He also attacked assumptions about Englishness and racial purity, questioning how one can draw what he called a black line between white and black on the issue, when on the one hand there were, as he called them, worthless and sordid white people who don't understand or who ignore the nature and obligation of that oath. And on the other side, to quote, all the descendants of Negroes, some of whom may now perhaps be seating amongst the nobles and commons in Parliament, he says, for without doubt there has crept a little Negro blood among them through wealthy matrimonial connections, a little generous there, in the course of near two centuries since our first communication with them. Indeed, he went even further by arguing that since all men are descended from Adam, then either Adam was a Negro, and therefore all evidence must be disqualified, or we pronounce against the authority of the Holy Text and say there were two originals. And there were, of course, some racist commentators, particularly in Jamaica, who were certainly willing to give that one a go. Steele also presented the objections of his opponents and suggested heretical solutions to them. He had the slave owners accuse the clergymen of advocating an absurd system, which would think of putting a species of creatures very little above baboons in their intellectual capacity upon a level with ourselves. And Steele also presented their key objection that there was no oath that could be sworn in court by these African-born savages, since not one in 300 of the enslaved was Christian. In their arguments, these imagined planters demonstrated a strong grasp of the power-laden geographies of talk on the Sugar Islands. As Steele had them put it, quote, such visionary notions might be ornamental in the oratory of the pulpit, where, by act of parliament, no man dares to contradict the preacher, but in a curing house, a counting house, or a courthouse, he would find the statutes of the island were flatly against such dangerous doctrines. And I think that quote very neatly summarizes the more general theoretical position I was trying to outline in the beginning about speech practices, the rules that govern them, and the forms of contestation they undergo, and as a geographer, their connection, their intimate connection with particular places. Allowing Negro evidence against any but the enslaved would be, his imagined planters said, opening a door to a train of unknown and inconceivable evils. In reply, the clergyman, drawing support from the published and unpublished writings of Steele's own Barbados Society of Arts, it's a great pamphlet because as soon as anyone comes up against a real problem, someone says, I seem to have had a piece of paper in my pocket from the Barbados Society of the Arts that addresses just this problem. And then he reads this out in great detail. And these writings argued that that Steele was willing to swear Negroes as legal evidences, as he said, by anything of which they appear to have a solemn and awful idea, by the sun, by the moon, by the God who made and governs the universe. For I never yet spoke with a Negro who had not something like an innate idea of such a supreme being, or by grave dirt, if you will, as it's certain the solemnity of that oath appears to be connected with their ideas of the survivance of departed souls and of future rewards and punishments under the decrees of divine power. What more could you want? They were then also to be allowed to hold property under a reconstituted form of plantation slavery. This is how Steele closes the gap between these different legal geographies. This would be a revived feudalism with the enslaved as copyhold tenants according to the slave laws of our Saxon and Norman ancestors. So those same slave laws could govern Britain and the Caribbean islands. You don't need different forms of legislation. This, he argued, would be the most probable way of civilizing the savages and training them generally to a rational observance of and submission to equitable and fixed laws. You can make them into a certain sort of legal subjectivity. They don't have to be beyond the law. Those subjectivities don't have to be as circumscribed. They can become legal subjects of a certain sort. Yet in arguing for this system, a direct outcome of his critique of the laws on Negro evidence, Steele had clearly overturned the fundamental tenets of plantation society, the chain binding race, freedom, Christianity, property, and evidence giving would be broken. Start with Negro evidence, pull that little thread, and the whole thing unravels. The links in this chain were also called into question by the legal status of the free black, mulatto, and Indian population of the island. This was particularly an issue on Jamaica, where the free non-white population numbered about 2,000 people in the 1740s, compared to about 100,000 enslaved Africans and about 9,000 whites. But it was by the early 19th century, I guess 100 years later, that population was larger than the white population. As shown already, although free and potentially propertied, these people had no rights to representation in the assembly or to government office. Indeed, their freedoms were increasingly restricted across the 18th century. A 1717 Act required those without sufficient property to carry a certificate signed by a justice and to wear a blue cross on their shoulder so it might be known who was enslaved and who free. In 1760, after a violent uprising among the enslaved, the Jamaican Assembly required that all free Negroes, mulattoes and Indians without real estate register themselves with the vestry, get certificates and wear their badges of freedom. Later restrictions limited inheritances and land ownership by free Negroes and mulattoes to £2,000 on the grounds that, quote, such bequests tend greatly to destroy the distinction requisite and absolutely necessary to be kept up on this island between white persons and Negroes. Their rights in the Jamaican courts were also circumscribed, albeit less closely than the enslaved. They could give evidence against the unfree, but they were not to be admitted as an evidence or witness in any case where the life, liberty, or property of a white person is or shall be in question or in any wise concerned. When they themselves came before the courts, punishments could include the removal of their freedom and transportation off the island. A penalty never applied to whites. Until 1748, those who were formerly slaves but had been freed were to be tried according to the same procedures as for the enslaved. And the evidence of a slave against them was to be good and valid to all intents and purposes. Those who were born free had more rights. This created problems of who could give evidence against whom that were resolved in 1748 by enacting that all free Negroes, Indians and mulattoes baptized as Christians could give evidence against one another. This act removed any exemptions that those born free might have assumed about who could give evidence against them, although manumissions had to be in effect for 6 months before former slaves could testify, so you couldn't try and play the system in that way, and ruled that the courts were to receive their testimony on oath in the same manner as if they were white inhabitants of this island. Now, of course, such legislation required definitions of who fell into these categories. There appears to have been little concern about who the free Negroes and Indians were. Mulattoes were more problematic for white planter society. In Jamaica, as in Barbados, their exclusion from representation in the assembly was made law by an act regulating the freedom of election. However, the Barbadian exclusion of anyone, quote, whose original extraction shall be proved to have been from a Negro, would have been unworkable in Jamaica. Instead, mulattoes were defined as any person who is not above 3 degrees removed in a lineal descent from the Negro ancestor exclusive. Thus, it was enacted that no one shall be deemed a mulatto after the third generation, but that they shall have all the privileges and immunities of His Majesty's white subjects of this island, provided they are brought up in the Christian religion. This definition was used as the basis for other legislation, including the 1748 Act regulating the giving of evidence in court. Yet these categories and the legal subjectivities assigned to them were somewhat more mutable than might at first appear. Tellingly, the 1748 Act not only precluded free blacks, mulattoes and Indians from giving evidence against white people, but also against any Negroes, mulattoes or Indians to, quote, that have the liberties of white persons by any law of this island. As soon as there was public legislation enacting categorical distinctions between types of people based on race, then there were private acts shifting people between those categories and reallocating rights. There was the manumission of slaves, most commonly in slave owners' wills, and the printed volumes of the Laws of Jamaica contain several instances each year from the 1730s onwards of the propertied and free children of white men and black or mulatto women applying for private legislation to accrue to themselves some of the, quote, the rights and privileges of Englishmen born of white ancestors. After 1760, with the increased constraints on mulatto inheritance, the subphrase under certain restrictions was added, but there soon appeared other private acts exempting people from the provisions of this law as well. Most significantly, there was the case of Francis Williams, who directly contested the construction of legal subjectivities on the basis of racial categories. Francis was the son of a wealthy free black slave owner called John Williams, who in February 1708 had brought in one of two bills, the other being for Manuel Bartholomew, quote, to enable him to be tried by jury as a white man. The Assembly and Council passed these bills into law with only one notable amendment, to, quote, leave out the words as an Englishman. The same day this was passed, there was another motion by another free black, John Callender, and another a week later from Robert Bass. Sensing the opening of the floodgates, the Assembly resolved that no more petitions of this sort would be received during the session, and there's no sign that these two bills survived the prorogation of the Assembly at the end of February, and no more such bills were brought in. However, once partly open, the floodgates could not be fully shut. A further private act in 1716 extended these rights, and essentially the rights that for so that slaves cannot give evidence against John Williams. Extended these rights to John Williams' wife and three sons. One of these was Francis, who was to travel to England under the patronage of Lord Montague, reportedly as part of an experiment into the education of black people. While there, he studied law at one of the Inns of Court before returning to Jamaica. He opened a school, and I guess he taught mathematics, but that makes him a geographer, really, because that's what he taught the globes, the terrestrial and the celestial globes. There's a wonderful portrait of Francis Williams in the V&A, which I recommend you go and see. And in 1724, following a street brawl and slanging match with the former Attorney General William Broderick, a committee of the Jamaican Assembly recommended the removal of his privileges on the grounds, quote, that William's behaviour is of great encouragement to the Negroes of the island in general and may be attended with ill consequences to the white people thereof. The law that was finally enacted by the Assembly in 1730 reduced Williams to the same state of trial and evidence as other free black inhabitants of the island. It enforced the wearing of badges of freedom by free blacks and mulattoes, prohibited them from carrying swords or other arms, and from living in the island's three principal towns without a license from a justice of the peace. But Francis Williams wasn't finished. He petitioned the colonial government in London against the act on the basis of the hardships that he and his family would suffer. He won the judgment from the Crown's lawyers, quote, that this act is impolitic in its tendency with respect to the interest and welfare of Jamaica, as well as unequitable towards the persons above mentioned, meaning Williams's family, and to the whole order of free Negroes, since it manifestly tends to discourage the integrity of the slaves in that island, as well as the industry of those who are become free. Once this dispute over the power of speech and the rules of evidence became part of an Atlantic discussion, the complexities and contradictions of legal geography became apparent. The binding together of property and freedom, as viewed from the imperial centre, was given more weight than the necessary alignment of race and rights, as understood in Jamaica, and the 1730 law was repealed on order from London. This transatlantic contestation of the power of speech worked the other way too, as Jamaica's white population, like William's, sought to maintain the privileges and identities underpinned by the laws on evidence. The significance of these matters of evidence and legal personality for the white population is well illustrated by the fury that the passage of the 1748 Act on the evidence of free blacks, mulattoes and Indians unleashed in some quarters in Jamaica. On the 18th of May 1748, the Jamaican Assembly was treated to a reading of a false, scandalous, malicious and seditious libel that had previously been declaimed in public outside the Kingston courthouse by Archibald Willock, a wharfinger. It purported to be a petition from the Negro slaves of the island supporting the bill. It was fiercely critical of Kingston's representatives in the Assembly, virulently anti-Semitic, and parodying forms of legal documentation. And the satire's main thrust was to present the bill as one that would turn the slaveholders' world upside down. The petitioners, the Negro slaves of the island, quote, who said they were unjustly and inhumanely detained in thraldom and bondage in the island of Jamaica, were presented as supporting, quote, an act to make us evidences sufficient on our bare word, as we know not the meaning of an oath, to take from our unjust masters, the white men of this island, their liberty and property, and to take from them that shelter to which, for many years, they have fled, a fair trial by juries and lawful witnesses. Furthermore, the enslaved petitioners argued that they themselves should have the privilege of a jury trial, that the island would only prosper when the white masters were subjected to the black slaves, and that any attempts to prevent our getting possession of the promised lands was, quote, contrary to our natural rights as men, contrary also to your darling constitution of Britain, contrary to equity and good conscience. The enslaved then petitioned for a further clause to be added to the bill, that all arms and ammunition on every plantation should be lodged in the black driver's or favourite Negro's house. What had begun with extending the rules of evidence would end with armed uprisings of the enslaved. As Joshua Steele's Imagined Planters had put it, allowing such evidence, quote, would be opening a door to a train of unknown and inconceivable evils. At the same time as this libel was being promulgated, there were reports that Dr. Robert Dallas had gathered people together in Kingston and read to them, quote, what he called a copy of a bill, the same Evidence Act, misrepresenting it and those who proposed it. There were also complaints about the publication and transatlantic circulation of a pamphlet entitled A Letter from a Friend at Jamaica to a Friend in London, printed in London in 1747, and thought to be by the same author as the satire, a Dr. James Smith. This, the Jamaican Assembly judged to contain, quote, several expressions which are false and villainous and are high in dignity to several members of this house and tending to disturb the peace and quiet of this island. The committee that read the pamphlet also resolved that the libel was injurious to the honour and authority of this house, tending to alienate the minds of the people from and to incense them against their representatives, to excite mutiny and disorder, and to destroy the well-being of the island and the inhabitants thereof. Willock, the wharfinger, was judged to be the publisher of the libel, and we should remember that publication can, despite the REE and REF, can come in many forms, including reading something out outside the courthouse in Jamaica, although try selling that to your head of department. He was judged to be the publisher of the libel by reading part of it out, but since he'd not done so with any evil intent, he was discharged. The author, Smith, was to be prosecuted for it. Now, significantly, the satire's invented petition was both sworn to be true and signed with the mark, a cross, of Cudjoe, and the threat that there were 60,000 ready to carry the passing of the bill or more if required. Captain Cudjoe was the leader of one of the free black maroon communities of the mountainous Jamaican interior. These Maroons were a mixture of the descendants of those who'd escaped slavery when the English defeated the Spanish and more recent escapees. They'd fought the British to a standstill in the 1730s and agreed a treaty in 1739 which guaranteed their freedoms. It also included a degree of continual judicial independence. They, in a sense, ran their own courts. This treaty and the rights it gave this class of free black people on the island was still a fresh memory, still fresh in the memory of Jamaica's plantocracy in 1748. The Maroons' free status contradicted the correlation of whiteness with freedom and haunted the imaginations, as Kathleen Wilson has shown, of white Jamaicans and the Atlantic world they were part of. Cudjoe's name on the satire was a clear sign of the challenge that the legal rights of black people posed to the sovereignty and identity of free white Jamaicans. The satire used that challenge to object to the extension of the right to give evidence. The force of deploying the Maroons as a threat came from the autonomy and the legal autonomy that they exercised, including in the realm of oath-taking. It was said that Captain Cudjoe had made real the cultural and legal freedoms that the treaty ensured by enforcing a Coromantee oath on the English officer who'd agreed it. The oath that had ratified the treaty's articles and enacted Maroon autonomy had required Cudjoe and Captain Guthrie to drink from a cup of rum or calabash into which rum had been poured and into which their blood had been mixed. Quite sure how that one sits with the transubstantiation thing, but perhaps other people can. Certainly not an Anglican oath, so we can say that, I think, for sure. So just to conclude, oath-taking and evidence-giving were powerful sites of contested meaning and practice in the early modern Atlantic world. They were embodied performances, localized speech practices, and forms of talk that operated both to underpin the particular social relations of Caribbean plantation societies and to knit them into Britain's Atlantic Empire. They were part of a powerful oral culture of government and the law that was made across the Atlantic in the early modern period and which placed a high value on the spoken word, or at least some people's spoken words. Oaths and evidence and the institutions they were part of, such as deliberative legislative assemblies and jury trials, were seen to guarantee the freedoms expected by Englishmen, even those who found themselves in the Caribbean. They also bound together Atlantic networks of rights and property across a differentiated legal geography. Fundamentally, these speech acts depended upon and worked to establish the identities and privileges of certain sorts of social subjects as legal subjects. They were spoken words that sought to enact the closing off of powers and meanings around particular categories of people. Now, this is evident from the differentiation of rights to take oaths and to give evidence. And one last brief example is useful. In the mid-1790s, the Jamaican government went to war with the Maroons once again. On his return to the island's capital from the war, the governor received a petition from a free black man and signed by the whole body of the free people of colour resident about Spanish Town. The free man had been assaulted by a white person, and while there were several people of colour who were witnesses, they could not give evidence in court. The governor had given, as he said, the recent and eminent services of the free blacks and mulattoes in the war, recommended the petition to the assembly, and overseen a law which allowed those who were baptised as Christians to give evidence in cases of violence against themselves. They could not, however, give evidence in cases involving other defendants. Indeed, in recommending this very limited extension of the right to speak and encouraging the assembly to do as little as possible, the governor recorded his general disapproval of granting such privileges. He noted to his superiors in London that, quote, "the admitting of petitions of this nature is extremely dangerous in these colonies, and the line drawn between the whites and Negroes and all the intermediate gradations of colour cannot be too strongly marked and preserved." It was the laws of evidence, what could be said by and about whom, that maintained these boundaries of race, religion and property. The identity of free, white, propertied Englishmen in Jamaica and Barbados was made through their power to speak and their power to deny the right to speak to others. Beyond this example, the regulation of the spoken word was a crucial part of the making and securing of the subjectivity, social relations and practices of imperial and colonial rule. and one, I would argue, that's received far less attention than what got written down or what got depicted in various ways. As I argued at the beginning, imperial cultures were oral cultures too. However, it's also clear that these definitions of who could speak, about whom, and under what circumstances were, as I've aimed to show in the second half of the paper, were also continually contested. Francis Williams' successful overturning of the 1730 Act, removing his privilege not to have the testimony of the enslaved heard against him, the dreadful predictions of the satire on Jamaica's 1748 Evidence Act, and Joshua Steele's unpicking of the social relations of plantation slavery via the contradictions of Negro evidence, each came from different social and political positions. Yet they all showed that if these distinctions, the lines drawn on the grounds of race, freedom and property, were only made via the regulation of the spoken word, then Caribbean slave societies might quickly be remade or turned upside down when others could speak. They revealed, sometimes despite themselves, that the world is continually being made and remade through practice, including speech practices, and that it could be made differently. This making and remaking also has a geography. In this case, these contestations, I've tried to show, all worked by becoming part of long-standing transatlantic debates over rights and powers, over the legal geography of the British Atlantic world, which undermined the relationships between race, property and freedom, which the Caribbean planter class sought to fix. In Williams' victory, Steele's heretical alternatives, and the world turned upside down of the 1748 satire, there was a recognition that the identities and powers of free, white, propertied men were not foundationally established, but were made through practices and performances, through speech acts such as oath-taking and evidence-giving. What could be said could also be unsaid or gainsaid. Unlike the assumed fixity of a text, the conversation would continue, and no one would get the final word. Thank you.